This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This is defined as an utterance, and an utterance is defined as having a particular kind of gesture, and it's a structural element in American speech. Now, this is very different from British speech. And at least it's not what British linguists are describing as their pattern. And part of this pattern is the other shift to permit the off, which goes up in tone, and wrong, which brings the stress. And all is not an utterance. Wrong, all wrong is the first utterance. Because look at that capital A. You didn't put a, he doesn't put a period or a comma there. And I ask myself, I too covered with a girdle. Where?
What do you mean by juncture?
Oh, junctures are those pauses whereby you recognize that one burst of speech is separated from another burst of speech. And the Americans have 3 degrees of juncture that they use. Just in the regular flow of speech. There's a juncture between words. The juncture, that's the difference between music master and music master. There's a change in contour, but there's actually a change in juncture for those two, for that distinction between those two I didn't make a comma between the two. But have more music master is another kind of juncture. And the speech is that you see the period is actually the kind of juncture of more music master. The duration of that juncture is not what distinguishes the juncture. It has the same thing that distinguishes it that a vowel does. It's what happens in the syllables on either side of the juncture. What happens with the tone, with the tone and the contour of the words. And that's what the line does. Let's write that line some other way. Okay? Because we don't have to go in lots of lines. We only have to take that first one to show, first utterance there, to show what the possibility was. Now, if we took a more conventional structure, that would be close to the sort of thing that I can't get the whole line on there. This would be close to the sort of thing that a person in free verse like Emily Dickinson did. As a matter of fact, what interested me when the Pawnees, you know, when the school moms finally restored the way Emily Dickinson wrote it, is that this dash appeared. Well, this is the dash they fought day and night during my public school education, as they say, to get rid of. As a matter of fact, they scared it out of me, so it was like I can hardly use it. But he has seen Emily Dickinson's manuscript, perhaps, but this serves at that point for and in a word reader. Now this one, however, is in the middle. We know very well, and it starts with small letters. We ain't in the land of E.E. Cummings, where we're going to have little small letters and no large letters because we're so humble. We're in the land where this has a syntactic meaning. So we know that we are not at the beginning of the utterance. We know that the whole sense of this utterance is that it's an utterance, it's the complete utterance, and it will bear the contour, perhaps. By the way, the rule of an utterance is that it has one major stress, and then all the other elements arrange themselves around that stress, and the only limits in American to how long an utterance can be depend upon the individual's ability to arrange the subsidiary 5 stresses, 5 degrees of stress around the major one. So that some people can read Henry James' long sentences and others find themselves in a quandary simply because they can't arrange the stresses. And actually, if they're sensitive readers, and if they are sensitive readers, they'll have reading difficulties when they're trying to read to themselves because they still don't know where to place these subsidiary arrangements of so this is very different than that would have been if we'd written again. So that was another possibility we could have. And then just think all and then wrong. These are rotations for very different ways of reading. This meant to me right away that the tone should be the tone of the word should be that it should be high and the stress is going to be here and there's not going to be a stress there.
Is this
there's a stress here, you wouldn't hear it if there weren't, but I mean that this is going to be even if I could possibly make it let's say a 3, and that would be a 1.
But this go back to what's still on your board here, the musical phrase. Is that where this comes from?
The musical phrase was to see the phrases and recognize that there were phrases within the structure of the poem. Well, people already knew it. Elocutionists reading the lines of sonnets and so forth knew very well, or let's say Robert Browning or reading Shakespeare, knew very well that you phrased them, and the significance of the line was something different than the phrasing. It had to do with the tempo of the movement of the poem, and it still does here have to do with tempo.
Now, what do you mean by ear?
I've got to hear this. I said a tone had a raised tone had to be here, and it's just all that ear. That's all sense. It's all things. It's all the sense it's entirely a sound. And what can't be is right. You can't divorce the sound thing from the changes in meaning that there are here. All wrong means something from different from all wrong.
This really is a person.
And so that they notate something to do in reading it that is subtle, granted. And this is really rather hard to do because at the beginning of an utterance of all wrong, this is with a capital A, it's the beginning of an utterance, you simply don't begin this way. I'm not sure what I'd do if I found something like this in my position. I would tend to just this is exact. This simply means that this is not organized in a sentence utterance. It's a free floating one, and there's a sentence to get, and I am asked about that kind of thing.
This is putting another burden on you, but could you go back to the very first of that, the colored pictures?
That's by song number 2, isn't it?
Yeah.
Colored pictures of all things to eat, and it starts small, doesn't it? And it starts in with the utterance level. So I think, again, these stand for first floating things. I think of them actually exactly. Colored picture starts in the same position again in the poem. It also starts in the same way that the all does in song number 2. By the way, you can certainly see when I'm talking about the nourishing, the tips of the earth and so forth. What a marvelous possibility there is when you construct lines this way. Because this becomes an absolutely intelligible. This is contained in the reading, and you recognize that it said that, and why you're reading it. Because it's contained at the meaning level, but the structure level is out of say, the sentence level, none of this is the sentence really begins and words, you see. So that these have a more floating organization here. And so we can read this of all things to eat dirty before we come to this dirty postcard. And we recognize why this dirty has a imply that has an indecision here, because this dirty refers not only to postcards and dirty postcards, which is unit belongs to, and by the way, we obey the colon, so we've got a juncture here that's different from the word juncture. It's different from the one between two and E.
Why do you say indecision at the end of dirty?
Oh, simply because it's suspended, and it also means that all things to eat are dirty, and it's dirty postcards. And the postcards come as an element of surprise because colored pictures of all things to eat, dirty, and it's like you can't think of what this dirty holds to because you know it tells of that, and then you say postcards, and this is, of course, the most common phrase for dirty postcards. And suddenly the thing you tended to see in the poem has been changed to just simple. And words. And of course he's saying that the ads, the things to eat are dirty postcards, which is another level of opinion. This is one of these is a level of opinion that the things to eat are dirty postcards. But another thing is a charged emotional meaning, all the things to eat have been dirty. It's not a level of opinion at all.
Coming, isn't it?
Well, the thing though about yes, on the human level, but you will not find this in Cummings because Cummings does not have this sense of the sacred thing to eat. And then, of course, you will not find this where you have a sentence beginning in which these things become significant. It becomes significant then that this has a small c and not a mannerism.
Well, juncturally, how do you move down from postcards to and then? What kind of
well, this is by the way of the juncture. These are members of the same line. This is the same juncture you have in Racine. When in Racine, you come to the end of the speech, but you've not filled out the Alexandre, and you've got to come to the rhyme. The next speech begins here, and it belongs to the same line. But the reason you have a reappearance. So, and words is not. This is the beginning point, but it's not at the margin. Things aren't forming on a margin. It shows that you are not. That you're in the middle of a line, at the end of a line. And this is the same line. And let me show you why it is. Because if you see on the printed page, it begins right below postcards, and it drops down because you are at the beginning of another section. And since this gives you a sense of possibility, it gives you the same possibility that you had in Racine of starting a new speech. And if it had been here, it would have been a continuation, it would have been a little bit.
But there's over some margin.
Then it wouldn't have been. It would have been a different line entirely. Had this been back here, or even over here, it would have been an autonomous unit.
Anything that goes back to that margin becomes
Yes, it's become the unit itself. This is line number one. This is line number two. These two together are line number three. And this is all over everything. The next line.
What about the double space in there?
Square.
Invaded, appropriated, outrage.
Oh, that makes them entirely. This whole thing is a family unit, then. And the invaded, appropriated, outrage, all senses is a standalone in itself. And it makes. For the first time, invaded, appropriate, and outrage, all senses, brings together what was hovering around here, all things to eat dirty, and focuses them, and so the meaning charge is all there, and the others become leading up to it. And then, including the mind, that worker of what is the counter state, and it gives you the alternative, the only thing alternative that is going to rescue you from the invaded, appropriated, and outrage, all senses. And those two stand as central in the movement. But of course they also have something to do about the self form of the song, and they are serving the purpose of the little of the sort of thing. Actually, I think of them as very close to Weber of short pieces for orchestra. But while I know it is Satie that made the impress on Olson, I'm not quite sure myself in memory of Satie. There are a whole group of short songs and statues of the thing called Fest there of Max Jacob, I think it is, that he said. And they do have this brief feeling. But there, and I remember they're continuous. And they don't have this business of little bursts. But that's what those are. Those are stanzas. You've got one, you've got a stanza that goes clear up from the color picture clear to the all, and then the invaded appropriate off-stages, all senses, another stanza, and including the mind that where your own heart is another, and then we have another group clear through the low, and even through touch, and then song. So in the reading, those really mean that you do make a real, more than a juncture, you begin an entire new unit for each of those lines, and that's why I think that, I mean, from there on,
I'm still alive. Is there in your sense of the play of vowels, in like that invaded associated outrage, do you see any kind of vowel that is syllable and vowel? I just don't understand whether Olson is working at this level.
No, because just as I hit it, and you will see when I read, his measure is exceedingly more complex and at a higher register, or more complex, is ridiculous. I just mean that it is more there as the immediate element of the verse than mine is. And much more active. Well, then you see tone. You see, the reason mine isn't is because I tend to tone lead. And when you tone lead, you want long continuance in which you can have these mutations. The vowels happen, and here you're going to get little flashes. Well, now, his by ear, by way, means listening to these vowels. But it may very well be, my guess about this structure is you want to have these things separate themselves and appear as little flashes. And if you tone lead, they tend to meld together. If I started something colored, I can sometimes even, well, I wouldn't even tell it that way, would I? Well, the cut of colored of, the curve of color, can be really brought down to our color to something, alert, color to bird on a paper, you know, on a paper. So I'm not up to getting any actual thing going right at this point, except the R's are going so that possibly I am. In tone leading, Your active thing is hearing these relations of sound as they lead through, and they are already, as a matter of fact, your first line gives you so much material. By the way, you can't, this also happens because you study over and over and over again the materials at this level of sound so that you have it to restore axioms of vocabulary that will emerge if you want to tone lead with something. It isn't the same as, it's not at all the same as a rhyming dictionary idea. That's quite destructive to the sense of carrying a tone through. What it is that you, the more you observe tone leading, the more you have access to do it. Well, it means that the pattern begins to form through and things group. As this sound, for instance, will be organized through, but let me take a poem. Well, I'll do that tomorrow, because you'll have plenty of tone leading, and Charles does not dominantly tone lead. All he does, when he's got passages, he's very good at it. But most of the time, he specifically doesn't want it, because he wants to keep the thing, and he wants to raise his threshold of the dance, this kind of dance, whereas my dance is usually, and kept quite modulated. Well, it isn't entirely true, but look how lurching I get. Instead of hovering, when I try lines that are articulated, my articulation is breaking. Well, we'll get to that now. Well, before we get into structure rhyme, I'm going to start out and try to be briefer than I was the other evening when I kept going back to the same thing. To give a sketch
and since it's me, it'll entertain you more, and I probably can be briefer. To give you a little background about where and how I came to the place where I was going to be writing the thing that we'll be studying tonight. But then I'm not going to account for everything, because that's a nice basic meta thing. But first, I want to give you a picture of, in relation to Olson. He started writing poetry someplace around 1950, and before that had written a few poems, but didn't think of himself as a poet. That was a decision that he made by 1950. Where I made a decision to be a poet, and that I was a poet, when I was in high school. And this decision I had never changed, although, so I made my decision to be a poet at a point when I didn't have any visible talents, and when I still do not understand how I just decided that that was exactly what I was going to be. I was reading dramatic monologues of Robert Browning that made me decide that that was what I was going to be, or was. It's really a decision, not something you're going to be. It's simply a decision. I'm now a poet, and everything else, as far as I was concerned, I started this. My high school teacher, who did have some sense of poetry, when I went to college, I was going to take a thing called English literature, she smiled, a rather interesting smile, and said, well, we'll see if that will work out. So by the time I was in my low sophomore year, I left university. I never saw university again until when I was in Berkeley in 1946. I was a great historian there, and I went back to school to study history, because it was the first great mind that had been at the University of California. One of those minds are rare enough, whether they're in poetry or any place else, and I didn't want to miss that chance. Everybody, as a matter of fact, two other poets already had switched from all other fields of knowledge to spend a law, but they were both people who went on to get degrees, but it took them years to get their degrees in English. They were getting them because they spent 4 years in civilization in the Middle Ages because of the teachers. Well, back though, well, by the first time I started out then in 1936 or 35 that I was a poet, and that was the only really important thing. By 1938 I had left college, and I did not write a poem which is in which anything really was happening that I could suddenly recognize in some term other than this is me writing or something until 1942. That means that from the point at which I decided I was a poet, and that was the only meaningful thing, to the point when I wrote in selected poems, the two poems, King Haydn of Miami Beach and the African Elegy. The African Elegy is the very first poem I wrote. I didn't understand what I was doing in writing the African Elegy, but I knew I had hit something, and I knew all of a sudden that this was a poem. Up to then, everything had been performances. I never lacked an audience, because I had the same general way of making it impossible for any of you to quite struggle against it all, and of course throwing myself forward in this way. But I wrote three poems in 1942, and then I didn't write get into poetry again. This didn't mean something I could draw on. It was not until 1945 coming back to Berkeley, Berkeley at that time it was, from New York, a little trajectory happened. Now, I'm going to give you, because this is a very important part of the reality for me, I want to give at least an account that before I went back to Berkeley from New York, I spent most of the year of 1945 in a place called Woodstock, and there I met a young German poet who was about 5 or 6 years older than I was, and we played one evening a game, which probably some of you played, where all night you tell a story and you hand the story back and forth, making up new episodes. Now, initially in a situation like this one of making up episodes, I was trying to perform and even trying my best to make my episodes of the story interesting, but the story began to take a certain magical quality. For one thing, you're telling stories all night, and you have absolutely, after a certain time,
when you come past the hour of midnight, let's say, and you start it, you're up in the mountains anyway, and surrounded by trees, not lots of people, and you go. We started, I think, something like 8 o'clock in the evening, and by the time you come to the hour of midnight, you're a little groggy, and you're coming into a very different feeling toward morning. But in the process of telling this story, and the next few days, when this German poet told me about Georgia, I had already read Rilke, but all of these little, there was some kind of, I definitely felt that there was some kind of exchange had taken place in the telling of stories, and that the geist that the German poet had, and it haunted me in the ensuing years, had suddenly passed on to me, and that I had entered in the world that he was talking about, and he had lost it. Actually, what did happen was that German poet did not go on being a German poet exactly. He's now has a professorship in German at Wisconsin, at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and writes poems in Europe, but he's not one of the new German poets. But he himself had known Georgia when he was young, and there had been a feeling that only to read Georgia in translation with a good deal of that prohibition I spoke of when I came across Georgia. But this seemed to be a magic exchange, and when I came back then in 1945, I started writing. The poems in 42 had actually thrown me off. Writing three poems had upset me because I didn't know what to do then. I couldn't draw on them. They were disparate. Look how different King Haydn and African Elegy are. And in time I learned that there were three kinds of things I tended to do, and that the three were exemplified in the three poems of 42. One is not in selected poems. It's called The Years as Catches. Now, The Years as Catches was a heavily Miltonic poem because Milton in 1942 was the central poet for me. And at the same time, it also had apocalyptic elements, and it was a poem picturing a future catastrophe, social catastrophe that the level of experience was not a catastrophe at all, but a kind of purification of the person one was. Whereas King Haydn in Miami Beach, if you know that one from selected poems, would seem almost contrary. It posed characters like death, Steve Haydn is the musician Haydn, but also transposed to an imaginary world of a Florida where I've never been, and in 1942, and then the first poem I had written of the African Elegy was an imaginary Africa populated by, as I conceived it in 1942, populated by persons that in the poem that were interpreted as being in the Freudian or Jungian sense, persons of my own psyche. Now, it was while I started writing poetry and even published a book in 1946, Heavenly City, Earthly City, that book, which was a year's term, it was not until I wrote Medieval Scenes that I knew what I was doing in a poem. When you know what you're doing, you are aware of a form being made, and you're aware of why all the parts of the form are there. Instead of being entirely dependent upon your impulse, it's still there, your impulse, and also it's still there that the things in the poem in a way pour out of you, but you begin to see the things in the poem as they pour out of you and know why they are, what it is they're doing, so that it's the difference between, let's say, seeing a movie where you do not understand what's happening, but it's very exciting and things are going on in it, and the stage that you reach in seeing or reading, where, in the same way, instead of just being engrossed, you also see what's happening and where it belongs. But there's a third stage, and that one I reached with the Venice poem, and that's different from knowing what you're doing. It's knowing what you're doing and being able to do it. Now, in the Venice, in the medieval scenes, I knew what I was doing, but I was not able to do it. The reason the selected poems is not to complete 10 scenes is that two of them are still unsatisfactory to me. Why? Because I can remember when I read those two scenes what it is I wasn't able to do. Why couldn't I try when I was going to edit the selected poems, foolishly enough, I tried to rewrite or correct, because I knew in some way, except that what I had to do in that medieval scene had only that time and place to be done, and 10 years later you simply can't call upon the influences that were around that made the poem. So there is no way, even then I felt or recognized, as soon as I knew what was going on in the poem, as I did in medieval scenes. What I also knew was that it had a kind of necessity of its own, and that if you didn't get it right when you were working at it, there was no way to repair it, any more than there's a way to repair a love affair, or meeting somebody, or being very foolish at a party, or any of the other things that you happen to in life, because there's some immediacy of the poem, which is, there's an illusion that you can correct yourself in writing, and many people have that, the way you sometimes feel that if instead of really being natural when talking to people, I could just sit down and figure out what it is I could say that would be very effective, and if I could just cover my bloopers, and there are people who do this. Stevenson said he hated people who practiced smiling in front of a mirror. And I read that finally in Mallorca in 1955, and I had not read the essays of Stevenson before, and I realized for the first time in my life what I had been competing with all my life, because I hadn't what I did in front of a mirror was make monkey faces. And I suddenly remembered all those bastards who've been practicing smiling in the mirror. Sparkling eyes and I can't remember what he said, people who practice smiling in front of a mirror, people who practice sparkling their eyes in front of a mirror, whatever it was. But there's a way of doing this in a poem. That is, there are people who practice getting it right in a poem. Well, this specifically has not been my practice, but even so, you're tempted sometimes, can I get that part that I was not able to get 10 years ago, or 1 year ago, or 1 month ago, once you've passed out of the time of the poem? And the fact is, at least, there are poets who can get it. Yeats, if you look at the way he struggled with those manuscripts, was always and finally would get through to where he'd gotten what he wanted the poem to be. But I'm telling you something about myself. I'm not able to do that. Once I leave, and maybe when we start writing on the text, is one of the things about these texts. When I leave the area of the poem itself where it's happening, and that can sometimes be several months, and it sometimes is only a matter of hours, I have lost, because the poems come from innumerable hints around. Now, in one of the things that I mean that about knowing what I was doing in the medieval scenes, do you have selected poems here?
No.
At the time of medieval scenes, the group of us at the University of California, it is a student town. It isn't any longer. It's changed now, and they have vast dormitories. But when we were going to school, we all lived in boarding houses, or we lived out in apartments, or we just really found. And so many students would be living in a house, and at a place which we really named its own address, 2029 Hurst, so I've never forgotten that in my life, because we had, it was the very scene of both domestic scenes and medieval scenes. A group of students, young poet and his wife, and myself, pacifist anarchist who was just out of prison and 45 in the United States was just releasing the last of its of the pacifists that they had imprisoned during the war, though this is 46, going in the turn of 46 and 47. We were the ones who were living in the house, but a larger group met every day for meals. And so that long table where there were gathered consistently at some 8 people, and then usually others who would come, especially when they didn't, because we always had the kind of meal where lots of people could eat, if we didn't have much money, it would be only one big dish that would go all around for a meal. Other people were always arriving, and it was also, had begun to be a center of people. Jack Spicer would, for instance, arrive every dinner time, not because he had to eat there, but because this was also a center where we're constantly talking about poetry, and then something else was going on. Something like the gossip I talked about the other night, about what the chorus does as it walks back and forth and tries to get something to happen. Because we were a snake pit of trying to get something to happen. And in the course of that time, I announced that I was going to write poems every night for 10 nights. And in the midst of all these people, I sat down and in a sense performed the poem every night. But the poems were, the set of poems were loaded because I derived medieval scenes with its dreamers and with all of the, and the people at the poets at the table and the pregnant woman and the old woman and the virgin mother, all of them milled around. The young wife was pregnant with a baby that she didn't want, and the whole household had actually become acutely conscious that the husband was going to leave her before the baby was born. After medieval scenes, as a matter of fact, I had been so drawn into this, where I had been neutral before the medieval scenes, that I promised her that I would stay until the baby was born, which was a serious change in my life, actually, at that time, because the whole household actually dispersed. The husband left after when she was about in the fourth or fifth month of her pregnancy, and then at the very end, Ina remained. She rejected the baby, and I took care of the baby for 2 months. But these were responsibilities in a funny way of what one did, because it was real, the thing you were drawing on, and because it shaped into some kind of drama until you expiated and had spent all your time in the underworld. The six seeds of an error, Pound called them, and they may refer to it as adventure with patches, but they refer also to Persephone's little error when she went into hell of eating a bit of that pomegranate. A poet has to eat a bit of the pomegranate, and that was part of what was in medieval scenes. But here I want to tell you, so in part what I meant that I knew what was happening was something was very well happening, because it was also being projected in the poem, and the first propositions of that poem were the magic and convolutions of our company winked its light, its touch is slight and vital, but we are bearish magickers, makers of lightnings and half-sleep of furry storm. It is the magic of not touching, not looking sharply into the eye, and it refers to a whole household of people, including a husband who no longer is touching his wife, and every one of them, in a way, living on this erotic excitement of intense relationships, none of them, that had all come by the time I wrote the poem, but I, to the place where any look or any possible touch was too explosive a situation for this whole group. But of course I exploded it by daring it and opening the poem right at that point. And in those 10 nights, plenty happened as this poem went on. And also, absolutely shaking revelations would come to me in the poems. Now, you see, I'm making a proposition in the beginning, and that was an easy one to make. It was a recognition I already had. But all sorts of other recognitions came out in this, of possibilities of something that you knew was the content. Now, not the content of a dream, but the content of a group of people who already, for 3 or 4 months, have been in such daily company, keeping company, and more than that, I was not the only one writing poems, that the poetry itself had come to be the place where you looked for what it is that's happening. And all of our emotions, the not touching and the not looking, was that really everyone then went to the poems as if they were a kind of mirror or a surface in which something even terrible might be happening. If you've seen Cocteau's movies, you see an art that when I came to see that it was like me, and then went to look and read more about Cocteau, I found that Cocteau in his own life had lived in just such households where a small group of artists would be, and then this intensive kind of drawing into a magic form. Now, it depends on numbers, for instance. You have a cast then of a play, that's it. Once you have this kind of a house, or this kind of a thing, as a matter of fact, all men have casts. Your friends are, in a way, casts of a play that you keep rearranging. What happens in this house, of course, is that instead of being able to rearrange this thing, we are every day responsible to it, until it finally breaks. But now let me show you an example of almost how trivially knowing what you're doing in a poem can have its source. And right away, but we'd already practiced in relation to other poems, the medieval scenes, when I started it, though everybody's decided, and it did become the poem, the seventh poem, that finally was what we've been working for. And so everyone tried to find, not only identify every person in the poem, but by the way, they would often change persons. I mean, you would suddenly see, no, this had been drawn from such and such a situation. And we were scholars of the life we were in because we were all witnesses to most of the things that would lead to parts of the poem. But one thing, we were having a very hard time figuring out where the swans came in. Now, swans came in because of Juan of Bordeaux, perhaps, but that's in one of the missing medieval scenes that is not in this book. But the first appearance of swans was in the Cygnet. Well, let's see, let's go back and get my voice for this, and I can read through perhaps the Cygnet. Where is that? Would be the main swan. Yeah. The Cygnet, heraldic joy, somnambulant, within the turbulence of want, displays his grace. The lion and the loin that slumbers shakes the sheen of sleep back from his cloth and stretches. Poets weave upon that tapestry a spell of flowering gold-threaded tendrils of a vine, make animate each animal form with conceit of love. There, as it washed up upon a wave of violet, of blue, vermilion, and clear yellow, the poets animate the unicorn animalization of the beckoning swan. The days before awakening's dark ages are long with hours for the poet's tapestry. The unicorn of gold and swan white thread nuzzles the sweeping virgin in the park above their heads, the signet of the prince, his woven, elaborate, blood-red signature. The poets that weave themselves as the erotic hunters, they wear bright jerkins of a rich brocade and silk of forest green upon their thighs. They stand with instruments of hunting, hooded falcons, spears, and heads, and watch that sleeping nakedness as if they had woven her, half hidden in the flowery spread upon the ground. They smile mysteriously upon their innocence, and upon their unicorn, virgin wildness brought to bed. They seem unconscious of the signature. It glimmers in embroidery of leaves. It swims the scarlet lake of some significant lionish princess of the sea. The lion and the unicorn were no puzzle to us because on the wall, pinned up, was a medieval tapestry of the lion and the unicorn, and then tapestries of the unicorn hunt from the reproductions also of the unicorn hunt from the cloisters in New York. But we couldn't find the swans. Where in the world were the swans? And finally, one day, as we sat, the poem had gone on, it must have been, well, wherever it was, by the reaper or whatever. Suddenly a whoop came from the bathroom, and triumphant Jack Spicer almost had no time to get his trousers lifted because he just seen that the bathroom was covered with the calcimanias of swans. Every day, in that sort of not seen being in the room of contemplation, I had been surrounded, we had all been surrounded by swans. And the bathroom had its own interesting we had a water heater that if you did not turn it off would blow up. It had blown up a month or so before the period of writing the poem, but it was almost
people were always forgetting to turn it off, and it was always rising to the explosion point. And of course, in a way, the water heater doesn't appear in the poem, but the room of the room where the water heater was, and then there was even another detail of that same room, the room of the swans, which we then began to call that bathroom, and it was not an association that reflected in our minds at all upon the fact there was a toilet there, which was the bathtub, and with the water heater that threatened blowing up. Because in that bathtub, something I did not know, but all those things you did, because before I came on the scene, that young husband had tried to abort his wife by forcing her into a near-boiling tub of water from that water heater. So that when I arrived on the scene, I was not told. This poem was also, I had been, in a way, by a devilish Jack Spicer, imported in this scene to make the scene. And he imported me in this scene to make the scene because I had already begun a process of making poems out of things happening with people in the first volume that was just being printed, the Heavenly City, Earthly City. So I guess you want to thought I ought to have a devilish city, something or other city. And I was not told, and everybody was speaking, part of the reason I was writing this poem is because nobody, by the time I was getting there, was saying what was going on. And it was not only not looking, not touching, it was not talking, not telling, and so that I was really working to force a content that no one was going to reveal to me in the process of writing the poem. So no one had told me. As a matter of fact, I had entirely different pictures, one often does, playing into a household, whether it's a young pregnant wife and a rather worried husband and so forth. You don't always get the picture straight. So I did not have the picture straight at any time in writing the medieval scenes. As a matter of fact, as people began cooperating around me, they were told all sorts of goodies. We would look for everything, but they wouldn't tell me quite. Although I began to be aware of a few things a little more positively, and so the poems were more and more loaded to see what I, in a way, would learn. They presented crises of information. They were read every evening then. The poem from the evening before was read at the dinner table, and quite a ghoulish company gathered in the course of this poem to have these little revelations. And the poem rises. I'll give you the last two poems because I want to give you just a sense of what happens in this sort of thing. Or from the mirror on. Now the mirror is the first passage in a poem that I've ever written where I myself was terrified by what happened in the course of writing the poem, and where also I was dismayed so that something in me did not want, in a sense, to be the poet of the poem that was writing the poem. It seemed to be a revelation. That was painful to have happened in my own terms. Although now my relation all the time to these painful eventually the structure of any long poem has some painful passage in it that is very disturbing to me to write. What comes out of the mirror? I'm going to start with the mirror, the one where I first became shocked, and then what rapidly comes is a charged and relentless drive toward an Almagencian horror of the body, where the person keeps at the end, voices in the poem, they are actually the voices, by the way, from Marlowe's play of Tamburlaine of his captive queen. Let me go. This voice, I realized when I began to know what all was going on and see the poem in relation to this group entirely, the group I was drawing on, I could see that the voice, for instance, was the voice of this young girl who did not want her baby and particularly did not want to go through childbirth. So she had violent guilt, plus she wanted to have natural childbirth because she didn't want to have it at all. And she made it absolutely untenable. But if she went to natural childbirth in such a way, not obeying the doctor and leave the doctor, had to remind her the day before she had the baby that it was absolutely impossible for her to have natural childbirth. And so she turned it, well, anyway, these are, but the voice let me go. The voice wanting to get away from the body was, in a sense, hers, but I've been brought so close to her as you were seen away from the mirror. And then there was an old woman, an absolute old witch, who, at the time of the medieval scenes, as a matter of fact, you see, this poem served to make me fascinating to the people who were in it. And this dreadful old hag found me extremely fascinating after this poem. I was a little interested in possible consequences because I wasn't thinking of where this frightening old creature came from. And she was to descend on me some 2 years later and present me with one of those embarrassing scenes in life in which people misunderstand and ask you to perform a certain, well, you will see. I just want to give you how acute a magic poem can be. However, I knew I was in dangerous territory when this came up in the sequence. The mirror. Two women stroll among the orange trees. Reflected in the glass, their nakedness is like a field of brilliancy. Well, I might as well give you a sense of where this came from. Now we knew where everything, by this time I know where it all comes from, except I missed the swans. I mean, where these two women came from, I knew the minute I started there. In Bear, in 1936, there had been a picture of the daughters of Danaus with their husbands from a medieval print in brilliant color with medieval fashion, blood streaming down. It was in a sequence of pictures. It began with men and women in a medieval bath scene making love, and it ended with a classical picture from the Renaissance. Typical subject of the Renaissance, which was ancient Dido, ancient Cleopatra, and ancient Mary Magdalene, dreadful old hag with snot running out of their nose, with bleary eyes, everything that the Renaissance could imagine would be the great beauties rendered hags, absolute hags. Now, I did not, I knew these intimately. I had looked them over and over again. I had them on my wall since 1936 to 37, and particularly the one that fascinated me was the daughter of Danaus, so that I did not so often have the picture that was on the verso of the daughters of Danaus, which was this picture of these three hags. But when I finally started to make notes to this set, because I wanted to locate where these things have been, some of the ones that are allusions to things. And I went back to my copy of this picture and looked on the senso. There they were, and so there was a locus for this old dame. The only trouble is there was also a group of these people also reappeared. The ones that had been in pictures were also in the group that were coming to this house frequently. Another thing that was a source of this, though, that was certainly on my mind when I wrote it, was a scene of Arno Feli and his wife, the portrait by Van Eyck, but Van Eyck has many portraits where you see a window with a light slanting through, and then you see little oranges against the blue sky. This is and in this picture of Arno Feli and his wife, there is this is through the window, and that is the window in the poem. And this is another reproduction which I had up. Now, my house has never had, you know, three pictures like this. My house has always had pictures from the ceiling clear to the floor. And at the present time, we have high San Francisco ceilings, near 15 feet. So we get about four tiers of paintings and halls and everything else covered. Somebody said, how can you write in a room like this? But you begin to gather that I write exactly that way, surrounded by things. I was pleased to read that Mr. Dickens at one point thought maybe he would have peace of mind by going to London, to Paris, right? And he got over there, and then the person writing about the particular novel said he was there about 2 weeks, and then he had to send back to London for all his fetishes, they were called. But I knew exactly what Dickens had to send back to London for all those little objects and all those paintings that somehow are a familiar resource, plus the thing that's happening for me. Now we will just go into this. Is there anything else I can? No. We'll just go into this. Now, the mirror, by the way, is in the Van Eyck. The mirror is in the back of the Van Eyck. It was a very typical signature. And that painting has a signature up above. You see, I knew these so well. I lived with them all the time that when I started writing a passage,
they kept feeding it, and at times, at one time when the oranges come into this, I specifically saw the window of the Van Eyck, although that's not going to be other details I could locate for you. The mirror. Two women stroll among the orange trees, reflected in the glass their nakedness, it is like a field of brilliancy. One woman's hair is of a lewd gold, red as man's first thought of sin. It falls across the heavy inlandness of her thighs and barely sweeps the ground with gold. The second woman has grown old, her naked body sags and wrinkles in its lust. Its feet cavernous wastages of a despair. She grins and shows her broken teeth. The glass is like a rose of broken teeth that trembles with the wavering of the air. The mirror does not ask if they are witches. It watches. There is a naked man between them. He twists between two fingers one nipple of the woman with a hair of gold. She stands like an unknowing Eve, radiant with evil weight. He holds the nipple like a blood-red cherry there between his curious extended fingers. The daughters of Danaus leave their naked husbands, each her naked husband with a naked bed. There is a carnal burning in the air. The woman with the fiery hair plays on her lute, the plaint in some erotic melody. I have it in my heart of hearts that freely she sings, that bears no fruit of misery. The man is standing with one foot placed forward. He holds the aged witch's dugs with his two hands and thrusts his blood-red penis in the air. She touches it. She smiles. Oh, all of human wisdom seems to fall into the reawakened depths of mystery. She is the woman with the golden hair. Her vulva gleams beneath the mount of Venus. It seems impenetrable in flesh, or as if some violence were needed of the man. The mirror shines in a still of muted lust. The image shows the oranges on the ground, like jewels in a greenish gold of grass. There is a plaintive singing in the air. Yeah, the daughters of the now still with blood, the six tears of lust and trust. The reason. Created by the poets to sing my song, or created by my song to sing, the source of the song must die away. All day the night of music hovers in the fir trees, swims and glitters. Oh, touch me not to song, for I desire to be forever mute with my first glory. The source of the song will die away. Glorious as the hot sun, the reaper in his youth cuts down the living grain. We see the glitter of his hot curved side, his weary labor cut us down, while yet we live. The source of the song will die away. Sweep not upon the strings of my dark lyre, my body, music, make mute the tree within the heart, for I desire to come into my Lord unsung. The tomb of muses in the marble of flesh, is it like a monument of song? The source of the song will die away. All night the pestilential reaper slays, we fall away beneath his blade. Our youth is daily harvested like wheat from fields of our first law. The source of the song will die away. But see, glorious as the hot sun, the reaper cuts my hot youth down. He cuts me down to my first floor, and yet I live. The source of the song will die away. Then there are two poems, the two where I was not able to do what was really necessary. I did not know how to render them in some way. And actually, after I had decided not to include them here, I really regretted it because there was a dramatic hole. And I have tried to be firm about not covering up my inadequacy by not. But I hadn't. Let's say the minute I had a selected poem to make, and I had a page limitation on it because it's only going to cost $1. So I yielded on a point I didn't determine not to yield on, and had the view that I had in this anthology in selecting, I would have selected one of those and cut out another in order to show what a poem from that period was like when I wasn't able to do it, because in my own idea of what is important in poetry, if you have to select, you would select the kinds of things, and not then there is no principle of things that are realized. Take away the things that weren't realized, and you've taken away most of the keys. Every time I read this,
I've lost keys because I don't have the text of the intervening poems. And these two that I couldn't handle at all rise finally to the Albigensis, where you find a kind of curse against the child that's going to be born. Not that I could think through this was what it was, but it was a content in the thing, and it's like a mother's curse, and it's in the term of the Albigensian heresy that opposes opposes the spirit to the body and views the body as a prison of the spirit. And then I was able to pick directly on Marlowe, for instance. I had only 2 months before gone through a reading all the way through Marlowe, where I copied out a notebook all the passages I thought were well written. And all the passages, as a matter of fact, it is one of the most informing things, and Marlowe is one of the people I do it with frequently, because I do not look back then at the things I thought were well written the first time I did it, and some 3 years from there I went through and copied all the parts I thought were well written, and I found I had a slight disagreement with myself and learned a lot about what well written passages are. But this is one of those passages that I just thought was so terrific in Marlowe that I begin to use in there, and that is, oh, let me die, wouldn't you love me, let me die. You can't take the line away from the thing in Marlowe, but it reappears in an entirely different context here. We move as dragons in the lethargy. The spirit of our Lord moves in the universe. He spoke to us of evil things. We hear the rustling of a serpent brilliant. See how the worldly splendor swells. The darkness of our Lord is vegetable hate. The spirits of the light move in the dark. They strive to touch. We know dim memories of their chastity. I know a serpent wisdom of the blood, a suffering of coetal magic. The light of our spirit is drained away into the flesh, the womb, the blood-red sun, the universe are bright with evil presences, angels of a leopard's fire. The Pope of Rome, magnificent with master, is Lucifer. He repeats in us, creates his evil image. The bride turns in the walls where devils form and seeks to know the devil maleness of her groom. Beneath the body of our Lord, Golgotha Mount stares on their paradise. The poet lovers in copulation know the emergence of the dragon from all things. They burn in the wrath of the wrathful God. Black is the beauty of the brightest day. Oh, let me die. But if you love me, let me die. Your grief and fury hurts my second life. I would come unto the source of light unsung. The golden ones move in invisible realms. If we could know their chastity, the consoled of God die away from life. We reach to hold them back. They grow invisible to our eyes. Well, let me die. But if you love me, let me die. Now, part of what made the intense magic operation in that situation, in that poem, was there was absolutely no love in that household. It was operating entirely on a sexual level. And there was a good deal of camaraderie, and there was an intense little community. But the total absence of love, because the husband and wife had come to a divorce, and the wife did not, and the mother did not love her child, is one of the secrets of the poem. And I would say now it was certainly a secret of the magic, and of why the poem takes this course, why the poem, for instance, is shot through with terror. Although the group is not living in terror, no terrible things could happen. They're living in a mute terror, but I myself, for instance, coming in, I was being played upon, as it says, my body like a lyre. I was being played upon as if I were some kind of instrument, and yet, of course, I became terrified because they were playing on all in me that did not love at all, and all in me that was entirely, that could operate entirely on the love. Now, what a poet often does, and I did do in this poem, and understood the operation then, was to tune in with everything around and drawn. And this can sometimes be terrifyingly destructive. That is, the poet can, because by the time you write a medieval scene, the important thing is writing a poem. And everything will be, not only will everything be used for it, but let's say I was Fort Wilmot, London examiner, just before middle of 20. I was rather ruthless. As a matter of fact, I learned more taking care of the baby than I had really learned. I learned more about myself than I'd really learned before. And so I was an excellent little magician in a way. But I was also learning about the poem, about how things operate. Now, the last time I ever really used a poem in this way, and the end of my using a poem in this way, is the long poem in this, the Venice poem. The Venice poem was the last of this kind of poem where by that time, quite a community of people could follow that poem in the way, let's say, that people did follow some plays in Shakespeare, knowing who, being concerned with what this poem said about what was going on in the general community. So that, for instance, people had reactions to the poem that had nothing to do with the shape of the poem. They had to do with their feelings about saying things like that about people, or about even revealing this and this certain place as actually happening that everybody knew. I mean, but at a level it wasn't talk. Now, in part, I did that to contrast entirely with what's happening in structured rhyme, because the structured rhyme is by the time I come to letters, as a matter of fact, my poetry is becoming increasingly impersonal, and that isn't quite the right word, but I'm no longer monkeying around in order to make things happen around me in order to have a poem, because but in the Venice poem, I knew how to do it, and knowing how to do it means you no longer have to have an operation outside of yourself in order to practice everywhere. In order to bring everything into operation. However, there's no way to know how to do it without practicing. And there is then a real part of the experience of becoming a poet must be some period where you undergo where you want to go through a very dangerous period. In the beginning, you see, you write poems to express yourself or to write poems because of interesting. I started out because dramatic monologues of Robert Browning seemed particularly vivid they appealed to, in high school then you did in class we did impersonations, writing monologues of our own. And this was exciting, and I learned how to go to come, you know. I mean, is that the right number? However, I remembered two pages of it until it took all those 6 years to get that awful thing out of my blood so that I could write a poem finally by 1942, only I didn't know that that's what had to be gotten out. Well, that first business, and as I said, I did have a nice, solid little ego that wasn't going to worry about it. I went charging ahead, and I had the general impression I always had, quite a bunch of dummkopfs in college, and I was on a literary, since I was in a frat house, I was on a literary staff of the literary magazine in grammar school or freshman year, and they were dumb heads. They were absolutely stupid, so that was very, very encouraging. My instant effort sort of started, and that was a terrible, terrible thing that happened, because a couple of them got printed, and certain awful friends of mine threatened me with them from time to time. In between, after that, I knew that they really shouldn't see the light of day, and I wished the literary magazine didn't survive, but every once in a while it turns up someplace and the people stare at these things from way back then. I'm going to read, there are very few personal poems in here, but I'm going to read, the impression right now is that there are only two. Anybody acquainted with the vine? Oh, no, the Propositions has an area and a little bit that has to do with my own personal life. The business about my friend Jeff had had an infected hand and was in the hospital, and I had a dream that had to do with the doctor and with a choice about whether his eyes or my eyes would be put out. And the choice in the dream, no matter which you chose, you were going to betray something. Either your fear either his pain was unbearable, in which case you'd have your eyes put out, but the minute I made that choice, I realized that it was more bearable that he would be in that kind of pain, seeing my eyes put out, than the reverse be done. And I had made the wrong choice, in a sense. And out of that is part of what arose in Propositions and did refer back to my own domestic life.
And so the crises sometimes appear as though I try to live in a world with no crises. That one was something that happened in a dream that was a crisis. The next time there's any kind of crisis in this, for instance, if there's one in Hindar poem, it's hidden, and I don't any longer go ferreting around to find out those hidden things because I know now they are the part of my poetry. My attention goes elsewhere writing a poem. Unless it's my music. The next one is The Storm of White, which is on page 74. And this, I said I no longer play magic, but you can't escape from the magic from the operation level in poems. I had conceived this book, and I conceived of a field, and I had begun to learn more about that field because all the time I was writing the book, I was reading about it. And I learned the name of the Romans had as its center a hearth under which there was a grave, and it was ancestors' grave. But I began to fear more and more as I wrote in this book, and it took 3 years to write it. I knew in the first place. I'm showing you my superstitions, but they are part of something that operates. At certain points, I have to make sacrifices. Now, I no longer dig for those sacrifices in order to arrive at the point, but I began to fear more and more because I knew that something was going to die, that I was going to have exactly that grave in the center of the book. I had, as a matter of fact, after A Storm of White, I was not. What happened then was that we moved. Jeff and I moved with our cats. We had two cats. One cat was named had a secret name, Pride, and the other cat had a secret name, Love. This was a little taboo territory. Both of them are dead now, but they had something to do with the way we thought about the cat, but they also were, for instance, little animals of this and members of the household. So let's say we ourselves didn't have to have Pride, didn't have to be Mr. Pride and Mr. Love at all as part of the creation of these animals. And they bore the burden of the two intolerable aspects of domestic life. And when we moved to this beach town, we moved in the middle of a storm, and one of the cats caught a particularly dreadful kind of cat pneumonia and died in an absolutely horrible way in a day and a half or so of bursting ulcers and all sorts of things. And it was the cat that we had called Love. And I'm not going to read Storm of White because I've already made it too personal, and I ordinarily simply do not regard it that way if I read it. But when it happened, however, it was I was simply unprepared for any perspective, and it was the first time I've had pets since childhood, and my relation to the pets at that time, my relation to these first two cats was exactly like it used to be when I was a child. So it was an absolute grief that I was seized by when the cat died, and for several days was in a state of shock, grief. My mind constantly going back to the fact that the cat was gone and to the conditions, and yet at the same time, sitting there. Then this is one of the few poems in which the poem itself is drawn at a time of an emotion. Usually in my poems, emotions arise and they belong to the poem. But this is an emotion that is an exchange between me. I was sitting looking out at the sea, and everything was white because it was in the middle of a storm, and you could not see the horizon, but you could see because it was a more intense white light in the daytime, the surf line. You could see a more intense white breaking, but you couldn't be sure what it was. If you really, it was within a gray, and of course this luminosity drew me, and I began to have the body tone that I have when I write a poem. That is, when I talk to you, for instance, I get rather wound up and excited, and it has to do with talking for a long time and having things form in this way. But in order to reach a poem, since I talk all the time about In order to reach a poem, I have to reach another kind of tone in which it becomes impossible to talk. Now, I don't mean Greek made it impossible, but my experience, how do I know when I'm going to write a poem? Well, sometimes I can talk about writing a poem, but there are other times when literally too much closes in, or it closes in such a way that you have no way of talking about it. And this is what I call body tone. I know that the only way to deal with this is to start writing. Now, sometimes that starts with a line. I cannot remember that this probably started with the just sky or earth without horizon thing going over and over again until it was in words. And then suddenly once I started writing, I didn't start there. This is at least what I think it was. I didn't start with that thing that was playing in my mind. I started a storm of flying, neither sky nor earth without horizon. It's another tossing, continuing in breaking. And then that had come together all of a sudden. I was trying to write about storm. That suddenly became a poem in the cap. I would ordinarily have absolutely forbidden myself to dreaded having it, except the cat was already dead. But when I finished that poem, nothing else died. I had a feeling that was insufficient. I had an awful fear that was going to be insufficient for what I was going to have to pay for having dealt with this holy or sacred or untouchable thing in the field. It was not quite real enough to me, much as I felt the grief, and I really began to fear the death of everything. And I made one of those marvelous. Now I'm going to talk frequently tonight and tomorrow about this business, where you have an objective plurality that arrives after it appears in the poem. Where let's say the book's demand is something dead, and then something dies at the point when you have to start dealing with the dead. And boy, did I postpone it! You see, the heart and so forth, and the connection of heart. And the grave. Well, this shows a funny kind of error, and it's not it's a poem that's got some real feeling. It's a poem that I like very much, but I missed the boat gloriously, and it leads into another thing that can happen in poems. I only had one friend. Now I'm talking about the time when I wrote Underground, which is on page 79. I only had one friend that had, the right word to use, that was lost in the war. Before the war, in 30 and 36, 37, because of the Moscow trials and because of the Spanish War, for a brief time I was a Trotskyite. And when I went at college in Berkeley, and when I went to New York, I had a misunderstanding, because it was a rather brief time. Virginia Admiral and I got to kicked out of the Trotskyites for leftist deviation and for being Bohemian artists. I think it was my eating garlic sandwiches. But also, the trouble was that I took it all very seriously and read Marx, and while that fascinated me to a degree, it didn't after a while. There are people who don't really want you to expound their own doctrine to them, and so that means that us people who are always expounding doctrines have to stay out of nice little clubs like Trotskyites, because very soon they detect that you have a deviation. If they can detect anything, you know from last night that I've almost got a place where you couldn't find the deviation, but something's wrong. Well, in those days, you could always find the deviation, because I come up with simple ideas, you see, and you get kicked out. Well, when I was in New York, I had a certain amount of sentiment left, and all I knew was that how I got mixed up with this Trotskyite thing was that I had joined the YPSL, the Young People's Social League, and so in New York I go along with YPSL, but then like an international socialist. I had no idea that this was it was just that our local YPSL had been captured by Trotskyite. I was beginning to catch on, but things were a little straight. I knew that Bolshevism was loathsome and they would kick me out. But I still knew socialists might not be quite that. However, I was then in New York at 18, it is, or 19, another young man, about a year older than I was, put me straight and started saying, well, now why are you, because at some general meeting, leftist meeting, I met him, and then his wife was a socialist, and he said, he started taking sides and said, no, why you know, against socialists, and he told me the whole history of what was going on in the Socialist Party, and he was an anarchist, the first anarchist I had met. Although we read at college about anarchists, we couldn't find any, and that's why we ended up in this other Bolshevik sort of thing. And then, so they were right about kicking us out. Well, when the war came, this young man decided he was Canadian, and he wanted to volunteer because of the anarchist work that was being done in England, and this would be a way to get to England, and he also felt very strongly that he should be in the army, you know, to contribute to the moral delinquency and general riot, which all anarchists are responsible for. So he volunteered and disappeared, as far as that goes off somebody. I did hear he was at Dunkirk, and then when I was in Paris in 55, just before I started on this book, when I started this book in the beginning of 56, I met somebody, an old leftist from New York, but a know-it-all type. I should have known and mistrusted, but I wanted the know-it-all to tell me something final. And I said, well, do you know at all about what has become of Jeff Raw? And he said, oh, well, he was killed at Dunkirk. Sad, very sad. The only thing was, he was actually, if I'd been a true blue anarchist over the years and read the IWW, American IWW paper, this same Jeff Raw was an editor of the IWW paper at the very moment when I was asking Paris where he was, and he was dead at Dunkirk. But with that charming illusion, and with not too much pressure, I guess, because something in me must have suspected, I wrote Underground. Underground, first more than fire, then liquid stone, then stone. Where there did the dead go? In utter subjectivity, placated death, turn upon their own steps. The old folks, no more than old thoughts, dressed in full regalia, dried, hung in thorn trees, potted, boxed, the polished bones cleansed of rot. Honored by verse that preserves the foxiest first of the boy in the double court of Belfast, Ford Maddox Ford as well, or Mr. W.H., half in, half out of ground, the double U that in the eighth of luck survives for love. Hates the monument too, all happiness and that eternity promised by our ever-living poet, wisheth the well-wishing. Go write yourself a book and put therein first things that might define the world. There's a great clock upon which the pole star will return, turn, and return. Kiosk stone mountains, a lyric gesture. Homer underwrites not adventure, but the way back home before Odysseus may shed a life's disguise. Charlemagne has a tomb and legend no longer intact, neither does its emblematic deed. Enraged swift upon his housekeepers removing a knife as he was going to capture death, shrugged his shoulders and said, I am what I am. And in about 6 minutes repeated to say two or three times. On a graph, a regular progression shows white giant, red dwarf relations of mass to density. In the poem determining the hue of words, the dead also are remembered. There may be here at the center of a chamber cut out of context, cenotaph for Jeff Rowe, who in youth fell at Dunkirk because war was more real than Blenheim in the village. But the old teaching is, he each year closes the year from us and is to be mourned by women openly. And the verse refers to it as to a secret, a hidden liaison between time and allegiance to the unmentioned, a constancy in avoiding the wellspring and searching for water where there was a star regularly departed from an old alignment, not sorrow nor happiness involved in a kept dimension that allows no continuous coordination of all parts to betray the still life cast in the pool of the eye that has not demanded it. You would think that would be allowed. Now, actually, you are not always right. Just about the time that this poem was blossoming into print, as a matter of fact, the very month when it was blossoming into print in Poetry Magazine, I had a letter from the industrial worker in Chicago, enclosing a letter from Jeff Rawl, because he'd read an article in the Industrial Worker upon the new
director of propaganda. I don't know how I fit it in with this, but my name was mentioned in among the new poets who were disaffiliated was the term, I think it was the society. And he wrote, "Was I the Robert Duncan?" And there I was, staring at a poet. Because I felt a little sad, because everybody I knew, you know, they were either 4F or pacifists, and they were all faintly blessed to get through that war without a scratch. And only one of them had been in it, and then, unfortunately, Dunkirk is... he'd been through Dunkirk, all right, but...
quite alive.
So the poem's not infallible, although the poet can be foxy about the infallibility of the poem, and I'll show you the sort of thing we do to make it good. And that is, we notice that it says, "There's a great clock upon which the pole star will return, turn, and return." Now, of course, when I wrote that, I thought that was a consolation about the return of the dead, but when things turned out the way they are, I said, why, of course, the poet always knows better than I do, and probably even I had a little suspicion from what the poet knows, and the clock turned around, and you found out it really wasn't so, after all. Do you, that clock upon which the pole star will return, turn and return means is that for a long time in Egypt they based their idea of a fixed star upon a pole star, and so they were among the first people to observe, or they were, I think, the first ones to observe that the pole star was not fixed but moved, and there is a huge clock upon which the pole star. Now the pole star of the Egyptians is no longer even near being the pole star, and there are a series of stars that in the future will be, before that other star returns, in other words, the northern heavens also, are making a big clock-like movement around. Around a point on which you could focus, and take a point, the Egyptians built temples, and look down, that's what the line refers to, is where there was a star regularly departed from an old alignment. In avoiding of the wellspring and searching for water, where there was a star regularly departed to an old alignment, refers not only to the well of the Hebrews, to which I've referred in my work in previous volumes, and probably will over and over again, that is the well at which Rebecca is, the well that the patriarchs are always returning to, and also, let's say, the fountain of our energies and the fountain of our vitality in life. But it also refers to the fact that the way they observed this pole star is that they made a pool of water, and then they brought the light down, and they observed it in the pool. And the pool became a sort of focusing mirror. And then some catastrophe happened in Egypt. The knot, their whole concept of the cosmos out of the line, because that pole star is no longer in the pool. And there's even a theory that they think it's a terrific business about there being a secret in the religion of Egypt. The Egyptians came as a priesthood, tried to keep it secret that the star was no longer there. Because the whole idea of the eternal religion has been based on fixed stars that didn't move. They became aware they moved, but they had something they couldn't tell. It's something that only certain people could know, and also it became absolutely necessary that only a chosen priesthood would look in that pool and know the awful fact that the star is gone. But then remember, last time we were trying to describe our own religious position, we too have a feeling that another star that was once in another pool and another fountain, or a fountain, has again lost its star. And so the poem has something to do with that, as this whole field does, because the field is pictured in terms also of the Hebrew field. Now let's not bother about this big field picture, because as a matter of fact, many of you have heard me start to talk about it. So let's go back to structure of rhyme. And against this picture of the places where, let's say, I became dramatically involved and knew I was going to be, and in the shape of a book, it is part of the central thing that gives, that makes for any body of a poetic. In letters,
Through Helen Adam, who wrote in an antiquated form, she was raised in Scotland, and she wrote border ballads like Scott does. But when Olson was out, he said, "What, you write ballads? Why didn't you get them printed?" I said, "Well, what if you knew? What if you knew someone who wrote ballads like they were in the 1820s? What would you do? Would you throw her to the wolves?" And then, how do you think? As a matter of fact, it is utterly dismaying to find her in this anthology. She has a few pieces that could pass, but if you got those pieces, they'd be the wrong ones. Because the illumination for me of Helen Adam was suddenly to throw over, and with a great sense of relief, the duty to be original or modern. It was a struggle. When I first heard her read, I thought, "Oh God, you can't do that." And at the same time, you couldn't think very long, because it was actually enthralling. It validated it. It was a real ballad. And it was primitive. It's a primitive art. And after hearing several and a set of ballads, you began to see what her poetics was, because these are not gathered out of the folk. They're really one person writing them. But it was an absolutely impossible thing to be doing in the terms of modern art. It was an absolutely impossible. It shows that, for instance, she must be absolutely impervious to all of her many, and she did have all the contacts in the world with contemporary poetry. She is impervious to quite a few of them, because she died in the wool romantic, so that she wonders why in the world somebody's concerned with anything but the other world, or the passionate affairs with elementals and such like things, the bloody murders committed in high jealousy, and all the lovely things the ballads people love. But she drew me. This is quite well. In 1953, but it took a long time for me. And I start preaching to myself and buying letters, preaching to myself a poetic or a poetry of imagination, and building an idea of imagination. Now, just that term imagination is, I think, the central. Charles, when I came back from Europe in '56, was just starting this book, and I think I'd written, I was at Black Mountain, and I wrote the first structure, Brian, and had read it to him, and he said, "Oh, he envied me, because the condition of Maximus was that there was to be no imagination in it," and he said, "He gets so sort of tied up since he can't have any imagination." Well, now, what he meant by imagination was that he always had to have this objective correlative. And what I was doing in the structure of mine was trying to throw myself completely out, where I would no longer check things in this way, and I would allow a certain area of my poetry to really do things that were, in a sense, forbidden by the media people that I was concerned with, forbidden by Olson. In other words, I'd write the poetry that wasn't really allowed by projective verse, or write the poetry that wasn't really allowed by Denise Levertov's insistence that you really register the life you're in with the media city. And actually, of course, these people didn't behave this way when I started writing it. They all started picking up on it in a way, so structure of rhyme had a kind of influence I never really had with these people before, because, well, of course, it had the same influence Helen Adam had with me. They also were a little relieved.